Charles Barker Nixon called himself the Slippery Man. He was a 40-year-old man who claimed to be from Scotland, but also had a distinctly East Coast accent, possibly absorbed from exposure to his wife, who was a native of Maine. He eventually became a stage magician who excelled at illusions and sleight of hand, but his specialty was the escape act. Hence, his self-appointed nickname, the Slippery Enchanter, because he could slip out of any restraint. He would often allow himself to be bound in handcuffs, chains, or ropes, only to escape moments later to the astonishment of the crowd. He was essentially a predecessor to Houdini, and would have been better known were it not for the fact that his bad habits tended to undermine his career. He was known for having a problem with alcohol and gambling. He is specifically mentioned to be addicted to card games. One would think that someone who performed sleight-of-hand tricks for a living would be a pretty decent card player, but apparently not. Oopsie. Part of why I bring him up today is that I find him to be a pretty amusing historical character. He's just so over the top, almost more of a caricature than a real man. He definitely rode the wave of the spiritualist movement, which idealized gypsy culture and ancient Egyptian culture as magical and mystical. This movement was searching for any kind of way to connect to the dead using anything they saw as vaguely spiritual or supernatural. Every culture has some kind of magic or fairy within their folklore, as we have mentioned many times. The spiritualist movement seems to have disregarded the culture as a whole, such as Egyptian or Native American history, and focused exclusively on the mystical and folkloric aspects of the culture. The movement kind of cherry-picked these more spiritual aspects of many, many different cultures, and made it into a kind of philosophy or pseudo-religion. In example, you might see uses of Japanese yokai, Chinese dragons, Romani iconography, and Egyptian hieroglyphics all in one person's outfit. On one hand, I do love this kind of bohemian aesthetic. As a big, whimsical ball of fantasy and folklore who loves stories from all around the world, I do kind of love the look of an outfit or a room where it looks like the owner is a world traveler who's brought home a bit of this and a bit of that to remind them of their travels and the beauties of what they have seen. On the other hand, I think it brings up the issue of intent. For example, dear listener, if you or I collected tokens or trinkets from our travels, it would be with the intention to appreciate its beauty. In the case of Charles Barker Nixon, however, this bohemian imagery was not so much a tribute to the cultures from which it was inspired, but was more of a way, kind of a way to puff himself up and to make himself seem more worldly and wise, and therefore more worthy of people's attention, and of course their money. It's not so much that he commodifies it that bothers me, we've all got bills to pay after all, but that he uses people's ideas of ancient Egypt or gypsy culture, which he knows that the people around him have limited experience with, and uses that to again puff himself up. Most middle-class people will never have the means to travel the world and experience the cultures that he hints at firsthand, even today, but he used the little bit that people do know to feed the stereotypes about those cultures and give himself an air of mysticism and wisdom that was truly unearned. This may seem a bit harsh for me, as I have already admitted that I truly love that same romantic, bohemian, magical look. My mom calls me something of her free spirit, and if I had an unlimited budget, my style of choice would be a kind of weird hybrid between a bohemian and beach bum and a hippie. Those loose, romantic, breezy fashions have always caught my eye with a touch of 1950s femininity, since I love the dresses and minimalist makeup from that period. I'm obnoxiously girly, if unrestrained, and as an American with very Irish and German heritage, I love the idea that there's a little bit of fairy magic around us at all times, and that most people are too busy with their worries and their phones to notice it. I think the world is still full of magical, unexplainable things. We've just become willfully distracted from these things because we're so uncomfortable with a lack of certainty. We always want to know better and pretend we are wiser than history. I think C.S. Lewis called this chronological arrogance or something like that, and I definitely agree with him there. It's both comforting and delusional. As someone whose brain functions in a way that Nixon built into a look, why do I find him so narcissistic? Well, let's look at another example. Jimmy Buffett travels the world and enjoys the folklore and people from all the places he's seen. He charmingly calls himself a pirate born a little too late. But he is something of a beach bum bohemian himself. But as he sings to us of the stories, lives, and folklore from his travels, he doesn't use these stories as a basis to inflate himself. A song about his father is not about him, it's about his father. A song about a little village in French Polynesia is focused on the people there and their foods and beliefs and stories, not on Jimmy himself. He tells us about his experiences so that we can experience them through him, but he is never the focus. Jimmy Buffett may mimic the type of music or aesthetic from a culture as he tells a story from that culture, but he doesn't use that imagery to promote himself, but to share the things that he has seen and experienced with those of us who are not able to and may never be able to. Nixon, however, openly referred to himself as, and I quote, "the great man, Professor Nixon," despite the fact that I've seen no mention of him as a professor or educator of any kind. He set up a massive bohemian tent in the middle of the park and dressed in an attempt to look kind of Egyptian, putting cloth on his head to look like an Egyptian headdress and hair. He used the look of what he assumed people think of these cultures, given the spiritualist movement, in order to make himself appear wiser, more spiritual, greater than, if you will. He was attempting to make himself appear more otherworldly and ethereal, but I get the overall impression that the effect was to make him seem more pompous and self-important. As you will see, the people of Charleston seems to have gotten this impression as well. In 1875, Nixon performed in Charleston at the Academy of Music, where he asked members of the audience, notably sailors, who were known as some of the best knot-tiers in Charleston, to tie him up. What interests me about this is not how he got out of the escape trick, but how do they know who was the best at tying knots? Is there an annual knot-tying competition or something? Are there rankings? How is this common knowledge? Do people vote for who they think ties the best knot? Is there an amount of clout that comes with being the best? In an argument, can you be like, "Step off, Stanley, I am the best knot tier in Charleston," and Stanley is like, "Whoa, sorry, Bill, I didn't know," and Bill says, "Now you do." All gravely, I like there's some kind of deep significance there. I don't know, it just seems funny to me that it's mentioned that it was the people in the crowd that were the best at tying knots that tie him up. It's so dismissive, like, of course these people were the best knot tiers in Charleston. How is this so well established? It seems very funny to me. Anyway, that's just how my brain works. I know it's kind of a tangent, but I'm sitting here going, when somebody casually says, "And then they got the best knot tiers in Charleston," well, how do you quantify that? I don't know. It's just how my brain works. I'm sorry, guys. Anyway, I can't think of a single time where I've, you know, compared my own knot-tying abilities with another adult. And I knit. But I digress again. After he was restrained by these masters of rope manipulation, he hung 50 feet above the stage from a chain and escaped in full view of the audience. In 1876, in the midsummer, the magician returned to Charleston, this time bringing his wife and daughter. They camped in a large bohemian tent near the Cooper River, just outside of town. In early August, Nixon did something that very few of us have had the opportunity to do. He dug his own grave and planned his own funeral. On August 15, he put an ad in the local paper that was a notice that, quote, "Professor Nixon," unquote, was to be buried alive on August 28. He would be buried for 90 minutes, then resurrect himself in front of anyone who was willing to pay 50 cents per adult and 25 cents per child to watch. Despite claiming to be Scottish, he dressed in over-the-top pseudo-Egyptian ceremonial wear, and both his grave and his coffin were available for public inspection from the moment he posted his ad until the 25th of August. The people of Charleston were furiously curious about this strange man and his stunt, and crowds swung by every day to examine the materia from which he planned to emerge. On Saturday, August 26, exactly 110 years before my birthday, he ran a big parade, you guessed it, for himself. Dude literally threw himself a parade. Goodness gracious. This built up even more anticipation for the event itself. Everyone was chomping at the bit for the big trick on Monday. When the time arrived, 500 people of all ages, races, and social classes came to see what on earth this strange man was about to attempt. Nixon emerged in his usual extravagance, looking like he was trying to dress as both an Egyptian priest and a witch doctor for Halloween and only had items from his grandma's basement in order to do it. The crowd reacted to this self-important figure in the same way that I would be tempted to do, and heckled him mercilessly. He had erected a viewing platform about 50 feet from the grave for the crowd to observe from, but they refused, clinging tightly to him in order to see how the trick was done and to avoid being cheated. They didn't want him pretending to get into the grave, then slipping away at the last minute in order to pop out for his mysterious resurrection later. It's hard to trust someone who calls himself the Slippery Man, after all. Because the New York Times was present, he even encouraged the crowd to cooperate as, quote, "You wouldn't want the North to think South Carolinians are disorderly." He encouraged them to show that Southerners can be as well behaved as Northerners, which probably stung a little bit in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, and may not have been the best way to win the crowd over to his side. Just saying, there's a little competitiveness between the North and the South today, but it was probably a lot more heated in the, 1800s. Just saying. He seemed disappointed with the size of the crowd, and claimed that when he had performed the same trick in Saratoga, that had been for a crowd of over 8,000, and with the crowd refusing to take their assigned spot on the platform, he stood there instead, performing some sleight-of-hand tricks with metal rings as he waited for more people to arrive. The crowd took this to mean that he was stalling, maybe even losing his nerve, and it wasn't long before the crowd was demanding that he either do his trick or give them their money back. Before they could boil over, he descended from the platform and chose 9 appointed viewers to observe the trick up close to ensure that there was no trickery involved, and then asked for the rest of the crowd to stay at something of a distance, though not nearly as much as he had first intended. Men in the crowd were still exchanging bets over whether or not the enchanter would chicken out when a small box with 2 vials in it was brought to the enchanter, who drank from them both and tossed them away. When he climbed into his coffin, and which was then lowered 6 feet down into a hole, the hole was filled with dirt within minutes, and a tense silence followed. Nixon had no means of receiving air inside of his coffin underground, and being buried alive was still a very common phobia in this time period. The crowd held its breath, and Nixon's wife and child began to loudly cry and scream and beg the crowd to please rescue the magician. Eventually, the man who was assigned to blow his trumpet when the 90 minutes was up and signal the coming end to the trick, gave in to the cries of the wife and child and sounded the horn after only 20 minutes. In a matter of seconds, the soil at the head of the grave began to wiggle and shift before a few planks of wood covered in a scant couple inches of soil moved aside and the enchanter himself climbed out of the earth. If, like me, you're wondering how the trick was performed, here's the scoop. There was, indeed, a 6-foot coffin-shaped hole dug in the earth, but at its head, a separate shaft, almost like a well of equal depth, was also dug, only 2 or 3 inches from the head of the coffin. This well was covered with a few planks of wood, then buried to hide the well from the crowd. Once buried, Nixon simply had to push the trick panel at the head of his coffin aside and push through the couple inches of soil between the coffin hole and the well hole. Then he stood in the well, which had enough air to last him the full 90 minutes if necessary. Once the trumpet sounded, he could then emerge through the planks and shallow soil in front of the crowd. Pretty slick, but it does make sense that he would want the crowd a little further away in order to blur the distance between where he went into the soil and where he came out. All in all, he earned about $200, the equivalent of $5,713 today, and used it to indulge his drinking and gambling habits all over Charleston. While the newspapers were raving about how Nixon could be a remarkable success under the wing of a showman like P.T. Barnum or some other such promoter, Nixon was getting into confrontations with Charleston police as he wandered around the city in a drunken stupor. He spent the rest of the month in the area living off the money he made performing seances when the weeks of living in a tent with mosquitoes finally caught up with him and he caught country fever, aka malaria. His career ended on September 22, 1876, when the 44-year-old was buried again, this time for good. His family left the area, and rumors persisted for years that this was simply another trick, and the slippery enchanter had emerged from the grave yet again. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and a special thanks to Lee for her continued sponsorship. I hope you enjoyed today's story about an arrogant trickster, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another Southern Fried story. Have a beautiful weekend, and stay safe.